Welcome to Tigers Tonight, a podcast dedicated to University of Memphis Tigers football. Here is your host for Tigers Tonight, John Maddox.
And welcome to the September the 29th edition of Tigers Tonight. I'm your host, John Maddox. This is the South Florida edition as the Tigers get set to take on the Bulls. And I'd like to welcome in the best co-host in all the land, the one and only Larry Marley, and going to play a little game that we like to play every week. Where in the world is Larry Marley?
I'm at home.
Oh, well.
For a change, I am at home. It's good to be home. Not for long, but I am here. So it's good to be back in the saddle.
So we had a nice, relaxing, quiet, calm Thursday evening at the
Yeah.
We all kind of settled in and sipped on some milk, ate a few cookies, sat back and watched the game. And
Just cruised. We had them all the way. Every step
had them
the
all
way.
The way. Had them the entire time.
Doubt.
Yeah, there was never any doubt.
Wasn't in doubt. There was no stress at all in that game.
One of the best.
No, I felt like I played the game afterwards.
I know.
It was...
Well, I think it was compounded, too, by the fact that it was Thursday, and most of us had to get up and go to work on Friday. And, man, I was useless on Friday. I had an appointment. I canceled the appointment. I got home. I know you beat me home by quite a bit, but I didn't walk through my door until 12:30 Friday morning. So, but it was a happy, happy ending to the game. We'll get more in-depth about it here in just a minute, but as most of you probably know by now, the Tigers over the Bearcats of Cincinnati as they open conference play at home and go 1-0 in the league and 1-0 on the week, and more importantly, 4-0 on the season. They push their third longest winning streak in the nation to 11 games, only behind Ohio State and TCU. The game notes... Memphis holds the longest streak in the FBS with 40-plus point games at 6. The Tigers had no problems getting to the 40-point mark in this one as they beat Cincinnati 53-46 in a game that had 1,300. You know, I texted you right before it happened, and I have the proof that I said somebody's going to make a play. And the reason I was so confident...
Nah.
Yeah, you texted back, no. And my wife's like, you're crazy. But I went back into my vault, and I realized things always end up that way. This is how those games always end, with an interception or a fumble. And, you know, this one was no different, but let's start kind of at the beginning. The 13-16 mark of the first quarter, Gunnar Keel caps off a four-play, 36-yard drive in a minute 25. Cincinnati has a 7-0 lead. Tigers go 3-and-out on their next possession, punt the ball to Cincinnati. When at the 10:34 mark of this first quarter, Arthur Millett grabbed a 59-yard interception, returned it all the way back to the house for a touchdown. It was a great read by him. I thought he did a nice job of stepping in front and taking it all the way to the house, and we'll get more into the defense here in just a little bit. At the 5:07 mark, Gantz kicked a 35-yard field goal. That made it a 10-7 ball game. And then Miller hauls in an 82-yard touchdown pass from Paxton Lynch to make it a 14-10 game. And, Larry, you texted me at the time and said that was the prettiest pass you had ever seen in person. He could not have walked. I say this all the time. He could not have walked out there and handed and threw the touchdown pass. Scary moment on the ensuing drive at the 3:50 mark of the first quarter. Quarterback Gunnar Keel went into a slide a little early. Chauncey Lanier got there a little late and a little high, and Keel's head bounced off the turf. It was a 20-minute delay in the game, but he went to the hospital, moving all of his extremities.
University of Memphis Hospital,
University of Memphis Hospital. Good grief! And I don't know if you saw this too, but on the notes on the screen, they said that Gunnar Keel weighed 805 pounds.
Wow!
But I'm glad
Lorenzen isn't 300.
That's right. The hefty lefty is not even 805. But in all seriousness, glad he's okay. He's a good young man.
Yep.
You know, deserves better than what Coach Tuberville put him through. He had no business playing in that game.
Oh, I agree. And one thing that should be noted in college football, there is no slide. This isn't
you're
pros.
Not giving yourself up, right? Yeah.
That's correct.
He went to the ground to avoid a hit.
One of the reasons why it wasn't targeting and it wasn't a hit on the quarterback because again, there's no rule.
I look for that to change probably next year, and this play will be one of the reasons why. So from that point forward, the Tigers think, hey, no problems here. But at the 14-11 mark of the second quarter, Chris Moore passed from Hayden Moore, the backup quarterback, for 68 yards, to cap a two-play 71-yard drive. Mose Frazier throws in a 9-yard run at the 11:03 mark. And then two field goals from Gantz at the 9:14 and 5:02 marks. Jarvis Cooper runs, and Shaq Washington catches a 21-yard pass from Hayden Moore to end the first half with 1:46 to go. And our halftime score was Cincinnati 30, Memphis 28. 34 total points scored in that second half, or in that second quarter of that ball.
And I don't think there was a single, you could correct me if I'm wrong, maybe there was one punt in the second quarter.
I don't think there were any in the second quarter. Somehow we punted the ball six times, which is still remarkable to me.
Unbelievable.
So we get our little break. 157 yards between the two teams and 6 points. Elliott kicks a 40-yard field goal at the 3:36 mark, and Gantz at the 36-yard field goal at the 1:27 mark. So now you're looking at a 33-31 game. And then as a supporter, when the Tigers come out in the fourth quarter and score first, Alan Cross catches an 8-yard touchdown pass from Paxton Lynch to cap a 10-play 73-yard drive to give Memphis a 38-33 lead. Max Morrison catches a 40-yard post route from Hayden Moore. They go for two and fail, but Cincinnati leads 39-38. Dear Butch Jones, you go for two in that situation. Anyway,
yes,
another
you
game.
Do.
We'll talk about that one. Okay. At the 7:07 mark of the fourth quarter, by Sam Kraft, who runs it in from 5 yards out to give Memphis a 46-39 lead. On the next possession, the 5:56 mark.
We got a two-point conversion on that, too.
Yeah, Lynch ran that one in to make
yes.
it a 7-point ball game. That was
very critical.
Stop me if you've heard this before. Max Morrison catches a 30-yard touchdown pass from Hayden Moore. Andrew Gantz ties it up. And with 5:56 left in the contest, Cincinnati caps off a 5-play, 75-yard drive. And then finally, at the 50 from 3 yards out, Tigers go 6 plays, 80 yards, and 1:34. Tigers stop Cincinnati on their final 3 possessions, including with 10 seconds left in the contest. Jannard Avery breaks through the line. Looks like he's going to sack Hayden. Tries to throw him the football. That was ill-advised as Leonard Pegues takes the deflection, intercepts it. The Tigers take the knee and cap off an improbable victory that even had Justin Fuente wondering what the heck he just saw, as the Tigers end up winning individual numbers. Hayden Moore, the backup quarterback, not a bad evening. 31 of 53, 557 yards, 4 touchdowns, 2 interceptions on the evening. Gunnar Keel goes 7 of 11 for 63 yards on the night. Paxton Lynch, third week in a row, new high 412 yards, 2 scores, was sacked once. Leading rusher in the contest was Hosey Williams for the Bearcats with 12 carries for 50 yards. Neither team ran the ball very well. Cincinnati, 36 of 132. That's an average of 3.7 yards. for 158 net yards for a 4.3 yards per carry. The difference in that is the Tigers had four rushing touchdowns on the night, Cincinnati just one. It was the Anthony Miller show for the Tigers, five catches, 156 yards. Tevin Jones, Phil Mayhew with 4 grabs each. Oglesby had one catch for 22 yards. Cross with two catches for 17. Frazier, two for 16. Sam Kraft, two catches, 5 yards. And Jamarius Henderson had a grab for 4 yards for the Bearcats. Five catches, 153 yards. Shaq Washington, nine catches, 120 yards. Alex Chisholm had 5 grabs. McKay had two. Holton had two. Johnson had two. Dowdy, Cole, Cogswell, and Teon Green all had one.
So I think Hayden Moore actually completed a pass to the guy sitting next to me, too. Go ahead.
You see that all the time. When a backup quarterback comes in, when now you got some film.
Here's the thing. You're game planning for a quarterback who is a veteran. And so you've got certain things in place for him. And a backup quarterback, and let me just say this. First off, everybody's saying how accurate he was. Here's what I want you to think about. Everybody's done this. Hang a tire out off of a tree and take a football. And when you throw it, you step into the throw, right? You step into the throw. So you're stepping into the throw, and this makes you throw the ball where you want to. Now try to do that flat-footed, not stepping into the throw. So with young quarterbacks, the critical thing is to not let them be comfortable. You've got to get in their face. And to do that, you've got to be able to push up the middle, not on the edges. Veteran quarterbacks, last week we talked about how we didn't blitz a lot early and we saved them for the end. Why? Well, because Johnson was a veteran. He was going to adjust to the blitz. Hayden Moore's not a veteran. And I throw this a little bit on the defensive staff. They should have blitzed him early and often to speed up his clock.
Yep.
And by that, I mean when he goes back there throwing the ball before he wants to. And you can speed up the clock and make him – if he feels like there's going to be a blitz or he feels pressure even when there's not pressure, and so make him throw early. He was playing pitch and catch, John. He was dropping back. He was stepping into the throw. He had no fear that anybody was going to be at his feet. Nobody's going to be – you want to make a quarterback stop? Hit him in the waist a couple of times right when he's throwing. Trust me, he won't step into the throw. And so I throw that on the defensive staff a little bit because they needed to blitz him earlier. He wasn't going to adjust. He's a freshman. It's not like Johnson.
Well, and I want to run through the rest of these numbers and then get to Cincinnati had 38 first downs. Memphis just 22. 27 of those 38 first downs were via the pass. Memphis led the way in rushing, as we said, 37 carries, 158 yards. That's 4.3 yards per carry. Cincinnati ends up with 132 on 36. Passing 84 for 620 yards and 4 touchdowns with 3 interceptions. Paxton Lynch goes 24-36 for 412 with 2 touchdowns and no interceptions. Cincinnati ends up with 752 yards of total offense on 100 plays. But they did commit 11 penalties for 101 goes on just 73 plays, gets 570 yards, which is actually a better average than Cincinnati, and they have 9 penalties for 100 yards. And one lost fumble and one that, now that I go back and watch the tape, I fumbled that football on that one. It would have been a fumble. But if for all the bad calls I've sat through in the Liberty Bowl, I refuse to apologize for Memphis getting a break in our home stadium. six punts, 316 yards, 52.7 yard average, four punts over 50 yards, one touchback, and netted Mr. Smith the Conference Player of the Week honors on special teams, the second such Tiger to do so. Time of possession, of course, won by Cincinnati, 33-43 to 26-17. Tigers were really bad on third down on offense. Just 3 out of 11. They were 1 of 6 in the red zone again. Cincinnati goes 5 out of 7 in the red zone, and one of those, the most critical, that was the last one when Cincinnati even down to the 19-yard line and the Tigers close out the game. So those are the numbers, and I wanted to spend a couple of minutes here tonight talking a little bit about Memorial Stadium on Thursday night. People were understandably miffed at the defense. And, you know, a lot of it is part of what you said. And one more thing about the Hayden Moore thing. When Gunnar Keel was in the game, a lot of audibling was going on, a lot of changing of plays. I don't think I saw Moore check out what he was told to run. And that is on the staff. But I am much more concerned with our inability to get pressure. And that is what caused...
Because when we blitz, we got pressure.
Our secondary issues. Now, there were a couple plays on the Gunnar Keel touchdown run. Terry got caught flat and, you know, didn't take good angles. And you know, I talked to Tony Graves about it a little bit, and we were talking about, you know, that's getting better. Angles will get better. Technique will get better. You can't coach depth. And let's be perfectly clear, you know, this is one area that we're pretty thin, and we've put a lot of resources into the offensive side of the ball and the offensive line and the defensive line, the linebackers. We're pretty thin in the secondary, which in this conference is not a good match. But
it's well, you know, here's, for here's all the thing. You can get away with it though, John, if you are pressuring and if you can get pressure. But we got I thought our defensive line, that was the first time I went, wow, our defensive line is small. I mean, their offensive line was just enormous compared to us.
Cincinnati's a Big Ten team. I mean, that's how they're built. They're built like a Big Ten team. But we got no pressure, and we committed a couple of really stupid. The Latarius Brady penalty on the unnecessary roughness, he'd have walked back to campus for me.
I would have lost. I just lost my stuff on him.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine what the coaches said. It's not for public consumption, that's for sure. You can't know your situation. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, you got to know. You know, and they cart Keel off the field. So you got to know kind of where you are and know, and it's called situational awareness. But I thought that for all of their maladies, and there were many, and, you know, Cincinnati making decisions, that score at the end of the first half, Cincinnati had, what, like a minute 14 left and 3 timeouts? We hadn't shown a propensity.
They just basically ran the ball out.
And we hadn't shown a propensity.
They didn't want to screw up, but I
didn't get that at all because – we had something to look like we could stop a post route. I mean, they didn't call it hardly. They called it two more times and went for a touchdown.
On the last play, John, on Cincinnati's last play, they didn't call a timeout there either and had 2 timeouts left, and there was 40-something seconds to go. Now, they had got a first down, so the clock did stop to move the chains, but then it starts again once the chains are set, okay? So the clock is moving. Moore is trying to get the play off because, again, he's a freshman. I know he's a redshirt freshman. He's still a freshman. We all saw Paxton Lynch as a redshirt freshman, right? And we remember that year. So he's still a freshman, and he's still adjusting. Why do you not call a timeout? You've got a first down. You're 19 yards from the goal line. Give him a chance to catch a breath.
I didn't understand several of the decisions. I'll take them gladly. I thought we managed the game pretty well. My only concern was, did we leave Cincinnati too much time on that last drive? But, you know, for all of the maladies, and look, I'm not here to tell you that our secondary played great. Here's what I'll have to say about our secondary. The plays we got beat on were because the quarterback had all day.
I don't care
if you have water. If the quarterback gets 5.5 seconds to throw the football, they're going to run post routes for touchdowns. Now, we have some technique things to work on. But here's the thing. We got 7 points and 2 other interceptions out of that defense.
You're right.
And
that's more than enough to win.
Regis Ball had one of the finest interceptions I've ever seen on that little sideline route where he caught the ball against his helmet. It was a great play. And here's the other thing that Memphis fans need to settle down and remember. They're probably going to make me regret that on October 17th. That's the finest offense we're going to see this year. We will not see another combination of size and speed like Cincinnati has this year. Ole Miss will come closest.
I agree with you about the overall depth of their especially their wide receivers. Those are senior wide receivers running routes. There's no question.
Here's my thing. I don't look. I remember back in the West era, I got into it with some tough fans. Number one in total offense. Well, we were number one in total offense, but we were like 52nd in scoring offense. I don't care about numbers that much. Did we make the plays we needed to make to win the football game? Yeah, but we gave up 600. At the end of the year, we're sitting there, and they're doling out bowl invitations. They're out and go, well, Memphis got people to the Peach Bowl, and, they pack it out against Georgia or whatever, or Clemson. They pack it out, but, back in early September, they gave up 620 passing yards to Cincinnati, and we just don't want it. Nobody's going to care. They're going to look down the comm and go, oh, that's it. The long story short is we did enough to win. We just played 2 back-to-back killer offenses that are, Ole Miss is tremendously talented, and they are a very good team. But
and they're going to score a lot of points on us.
I don't want to go there until we have to, but – they're a great team. They're well coached. They're deep. They're strong. They're athletic. They'll be the best quote total team we'll see this year. But
is this a Josh Pastner
played the two
conference?
Best. Well, they're well
they're
coached.
Great team.
Dear
they're
friend.
Well coached.
He's a dear friend. And they run great stuff.
Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Did I leave any of the? Did I leave any of the cliches out there?
I don't know yet. But anyway.
I think we covered all of them. Anyway, but 2 great offenses in 2 consecutive weeks. We will not see a great offense this week. If you take the 1AA game out, they've scored 17 points in their 2 losses. Or, I'm sorry, their FCS game, which you can't do. Right. It's stats or stats, but if you take that out. So I'm interested in this game, but few more things about the Cincinnati game. I thought that we didn't have a good game plan. I'll just be perfectly honest on the defensive side of the ball.
You're absolutely right. And I just said that. we did not do – forget Hayden Moore. If it was Gunnar Keel, we still needed to blitz more. But
so
I,
we're gonna
– and I also think the pick six was fool's gold for us. Because the guy, the defensive coaches went, hey, we can lay back a little bit and let them make a mistake. Well, the problem there was they didn't really make any mistakes. They had the 3 picks, but he hit every open receiver.
We're gonna deviate a little bit from the plan here. Our guest has called in a few minutes early, and I want to go ahead and get him on. Thank him for his time here tonight. We're going to Jeff Odom. Jeff is the Tampa Bay Times beat writer. He also writes for the USF Oracle. He covers South Florida football, basketball, all that good stuff. Jeff, welcome in from beautiful, scenic, and I'm going to assume crime-free Tampa, Florida this evening. Jeff, are you there? All right, we'll try to get him back here in just a couple minutes.
Okay.
Obviously having some connection problems. But so, yeah, we'll go ahead. Tell you what, let's jump ahead. Let's do the weather, and we'll do the weather break, and then we'll try to bring our guest on. Your Tiger.
Typical early fall conditions expected on the Gulf Coast as the Tigers travel south this Friday night. This is your Tiger Tonight, MemphisWeather.net first forecast for Friday evening, 6 p.m. down in Tampa, Florida at Raymond James Stadium as the Tigers take on the South Florida Bulls. Partly cloudy skies, a 30% chance of a thunderstorm early in the game, and then just to a 20% chance later. Temperatures around 81 at kickoff, falling into the upper 70s during the game. It will be humid, winds out of the northwest at 5 to 10 miles an hour. For the latest human-powered local forecast, download the MemphisWeather.net app for iOS or Android devices from your App Store, and be sure to check out StormWatch Plus, our precision severe weather alert technology embedded within the app. For MemphisWeather.net, I'm U of M alum Eric Procius. Go Tigers!
All right. Thanks a lot, Eric. We appreciate those forecasts every week, whether we are on the road. And weather does not really look to be much of a factor here. Again, we're trying to get our guest on. Let's try this again. And, Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, guys, how you doing?
Hey, good. Welcome in, Jeff Odom here. Jeff is he's the USF correspondent for the Tampa Bay Times. That's cool as well. And thanks for jumping on with us here on such short notice today. And how are things in beautiful, scenic, crime-free Tampa, Florida tonight?
Well, it's been raining the last couple of days, so it hasn't been too bright and sunny like it usually is, but not too bad. It's a nice couple of days getting ready for USF's Friday night showdown with Memphis.
So USF coming off, they start the season 1-2, a big win, of course, over Florida A&M. They put up 556 yards and 7 touchdowns. Then they travel up to Tallahassee. Tight game, tied at 7 at the half, but just not at 13. Then they go to College Park, Maryland, continue their ACC tour old habits die hard. Maryland's in the Big Ten now. I still can't get used to that. As they fall 35-17, USF did pick off 3 passes. So what, what are the Tigers looking at in terms of the USF offense? What do these guys like to do? What is Coach Taggart like run, pass? Is he like to be balanced? How's USF going to fare offensively?
Well, it's actually been a big change from what Memphis has seen from USF the last couple of seasons. When Willie Taggart first got to USF from Western Kentucky, he was running more of that Harbaugh-style, West Coast power run kind of offense. And he kind of figured out after a couple of years that it really wasn't working with the kind of athletes that USF had on the field and the guys they were trying to recruit. So for this season, they brought in Danny Hope, the former Purdue head coach, and elevated him to co-offensive coordinator. And they kind of worked with him and quarterbacks coach David Reeves to put forth a little bit of more of an up-tempo style system, kind of similar to what Oregon has ran the last few years under Chip Kelly, and after he left to go to Philadelphia, what they're still running up there, and in Memphis at Clemson as well. So they're kind of trying to institute this power or this up-tempo kind of spread offense, and they got the dual threat quarterback in Quentin Flowers, who surprisingly actually has more rushing yards than passing yards in the first 3 games this season. So he's actually on pace for a top 10 rushing season at USF, which would be a pretty big deal. So they haven't had a quarterback that can really do that since B.J. Daniels graduated 3 years ago. And, of course, you always got to, when you look at USF's offense, you always got to look at Marlon Mack, the sophomore running back, was the American Athletic Conference's Rookie of the Year last year, kind of had a big breakout season and became just the third or fourth 1,000-yard running back in USF history. So those two guys are the most potent on this offense. Quentin's making just his fifth start. He made 1 last season, and he's made 3 this year. So he's still kind of trying to get it down as far as the offense is concerned and kind of get into this, elevated to this college game. But there's plenty of weapons on the outside with Rodney Adams, wide receiver, and Rysheen Bronson, and Chris Barr, Those guys are pretty fast, and even their backup running backs too. Darius Tice, Dernis Johnson, who's the second string running back, who's actually become their leading wide receiver at this point. He had a big 71-yard touchdown reception against Florida State a couple weeks ago. So they kind of have a lot of pieces around him, a lot of fast pieces. The offense is still kind of trying to get itself in gear a little bit, but I think that's what you'll see out of this team. A lot of similar style to what you see around college football nowadays, and that spread kind of system that's been going around the last few years.
Yeah, you look at the just the straight up and down numbers, and Memphis ranks third in the country at 53.8 points per game. Still unbelievable to me. Has struggled a bit, 27.3. Guys, if we're sitting here 6-7 years ago and you're averaging 27.3 points a game, that's probably good for 10th or 11th in the country. But now that's got you at 84 in the country. South Florida 92nd at 376.7. Tigers historically, as Larry will tell you, we've struggled against. How about the offensive line? What are there any standouts there? Is it kind of by committee, or how does that work?
That was actually the biggest question mark coming into this season. USF lost a couple big guys on that offensive line. Austin Ryder graduated. He was a seventh-round draft pick by the Redskins. He went into camp up there, and he didn't make it as a backup center, so he's on the practice squad. And Darrell Williams was another big offensive lineman they lost. He's now with the St. Louis Rams. So right now, their two biggest keys on that line are center Brynjar Gudmundsson, it's his first time he's actually played center in an actual game-like setting. He started against Florida A&M a couple weeks ago. He's kind of coming along pretty nicely. He made a few mistakes in that FSU game, but he kind of bounced back pretty well against Maryland. And then you got Thor Joswiak, who we like to joke about could be a future WWE wrestler. I mean, he's a very fired up guy. He dealt with some serious health problems a couple years ago. Had a heart problem that kept him out of an entire season back in 2013. But he's really become that vocal leader along that line. And the rest of the guys, it's kind of hard to really get a gauge. We're going into the fourth game of the season. It's really hard to kind of get a gauge on just how good these guys are, because it is a young line. There's Mac Jubegovic, who's he came from very small private school, was a walk-on, and finally earned a scholarship. They missed out a big opportunity. They got a big JUCO guy in the offseason, and Glenn Bethel. He came out of a junior college, one of the top-rated linemen in the country, but he couldn't make it academically. There's Riley Givens, the Stanford transfer, who's been dealing with a little bit of a knee issue. So, it obviously, you won't see the full effect of what USF's offensive line is supposed to look like on Friday, but so far in that kind of by committee approach they've used in certain positions, they've done pretty decently these first few games against a very tough opponent in Florida State, and a pretty good defense in Maryland as well.
Yeah, and you got a guy named Thor. I mean, it's kind of hard to go wrong with a guy named Thor on your offense.
Exactly.
We had a tank as a linebacker last year, and his real name was even scarier. Brontavious is much scarier. Is much scarier than Tank, but he graduated.
Why would you change your name? First off, you're a football player. Why would
if your name was Brontavious, why would you want to be anything else?
Exactly.
So now we'll move to the other side of the football. Guys like Nigel Harris, who led the nation with 6 forced fumbles last year, 3-4, 4-3, 4-2. I think you guys have moved this year to a 4-2-5. Tell us a little bit about the defense.
The 4-2-5 system, much like the offense, it was brought in by Tom Allen, the former linebackers coach over at Ole Miss, part of that Hugh Freeze coaching tree. He came in, he instituted the system, and USF had Chuck Bresnahan as its defensive coordinator last year, and he was a guy that had bounced around in the NFL a little bit with the Raiders and Bengals, and his system that he was running last season, it was more out of a necessity just because the USF defense didn't have a lot of depth But this season, you know, that's something they do have a lot of. They have a lot of depth, and this system really fits what they're trying to do well, this 4-2-5 system. And especially against a team like Memphis, USF utilizing five defensive backs, you know, using some linebackers in some pretty unique positions to kind of go after and can cover some of these receivers against a Memphis offense that likes to pass the ball with Paxton Lynch. And it's also shown a little bit this year that they're able to get to the quarterback a little more. And I know, you know, Florida A&M's not a very good judgment of what a defense can be because, you know, it's Florida A&M. They haven't had a lot of success these last few years as a lower-tier Division I AA team. But, you know, they were really getting to the quarterback well in that game. They had, in that Florida State game, they had Everett Golson pressured really well in that first half. I think he was 1 of 9 passing for 6 yards. I mean, it really it was pretty spectacular to see just how well they were doing there as far as stopping the air attack. But the one issue that has been pretty obvious and pretty glaring from this defense has been their inability to stop the run. We saw Dalvin Cook in that Florida State game run all over this defense, torched him for over 200 yards, had the finest day in, gosh, 25 years of any Florida State running back. And when you think of the backs and the players that have come through that program, it's kind of unbelievable to see, you know, just how well he played against USF's defense. So their biggest key in this game will be to limit that explosive play, which is going to be very difficult, obviously, to do against Memphis just because of Memphis's ability to get that ball downfield and score a lot of points. I mean, gosh, Memphis is coming off, what, 6 straight games with 40 or more points. It's pretty unbelievable to think about, and that's the longest active streak in Division I. So, you know, they really...
Do you know the last team to keep us under 40?
I believe it was Temple, if I'm not mistaken. Was it Temple?
No, sir.
Yes.
Was it Temple
because we played South Florida before we played Temple. Yeah.
Oh, we did? I thought it was.
Yeah, I think we played.
I thought it was flip-flopped.
But no, South Florida held us. South Florida holds us to 31 last year. So
that's right. Yeah, that's right.
I thought we were flip-flopped. I apologize.
That's okay.
But anyway, so you guys were the last ones to do it at home when we were at home because anyway.
So tell us a little bit about special teams. Your punter, it looks like, is on the Ray Guy Award watch list, and you had a long Tajay Fullwood who had a 46-yard punt return at FSU. So tell us a little bit about the teams.
Yeah, the USF special teams, that's been, I think, their biggest strong point over the last 3 years. You know, the offense has struggled, the defense has struggled at times, and it's really been – you know, kind of a mess and a little bit chaos on that side of the ball, but special teams has kind of been this team's rock. And you mentioned Matias Chabadi. He's been a great asset for this team as far as punting the ball goes. And I think arguably you could probably argue that he's one of their better players. I mean, he has a heck of a right leg. I mean, he came in as a walk-on, a local guy that was recruited by Skip Holtz before he was fired back in 2012, and he was named the punter a couple of years ago, and he's kind of ran away with it. He's possibly, you know, going to be in the NFL next year, and you know, he's one of those guys that, you know, USF offense doesn't do very well, puts him in a bad spot, and he can punt it, you know, 60, 65 yards downfield and really give, you know, opposing teams some headaches. But on the punt return side of things, USF starter Hassan Childs going into the season tore his ACL in the final couple of days of practice, and they decided to have a little bit of a committee approach to it. And Tajay Fullwood has done a really good job of you know, taking over for a guy named Chris Dunkley, who was the returner last season, and you know, he was mainly a defensive back and it had been a wide receiver, and so he's kind of filled that, you know, role without really any issues. I know Willie Taggart's alluded to it a little bit that he would like to give Dernis Johnson an opportunity to get back there and return some punts potentially on Friday. He wanted to do, I think, a little bit against Memphis or against Maryland rather, but didn't really have an opportunity to put him in there. So I mean, those two, you know, spots have been key. USF lost its former Groza Award finalist and Marvin Clough at kicker. He graduated last season. He had scored the most points for USF over the last two seasons, which is, you know, not exactly your ideal situation, having your kicker with the most points on your team, but they haven't really had too much trouble at the kicking position. Emilio Nadelman, a sophomore from down in Miami, he's kind of he flew under the radar a little bit in camp, and he won the starting job on the last day, and he's made a couple field goals, and so I think Willie Taggart's pretty confident in that side of the on that side of the spectrum with this team. I don't think they have any glaring issues on special teams. That's mostly, you know, tackling's been an issue on when other teams are returning the football and punts and kickoffs, but that's kind of been the most glaring problem that I've seen over the last couple of weeks to start this season.
And a couple things, actually, Larry, you were correct, yeah.
Yes, I'm vindicated.
you are vindicated. USF, the last team to hold us under 40 points. And Larry, you would like to hold number
22nd.
One. He's a civil engineering graduate with a 3.5 GPA, and he's a 4 handicap in golf. So that's not bad for a punter.
No.
So, you know, Jeff, why don't we have you? One of the reasons I wanted to have somebody from down there. Willie Taggart and Justin Fuente are actually within 1 month of one another of being the youngest head coaches in the league, and their paths have gone quite a bit differently. And, you know, Taggart comes in, he's 23-40 overall, but just 7-20 at USF. He was 16-20 where, of course, he was his alma mater. What is the general kind of consensus around the program right now as it relates directly to him? This is his third year, starting off 1-2, chance to start off 1-3. What's kind of the general feel around the program as it relates to coaching?
Well, the general consensus that we've gotten is that this really is his make or break season. You know, it's really it's been a tough going for him the last couple of years. In his first couple of years with USF, you know, to his credit, he took over a program that was just, you know, the cup board was left bare, for lack of a better term, by Skip Holtz. And you know, he took over a team that didn't have any quarterbacks. It didn't really have a good running back. Fortunately, he had a pretty good receiver in Andre Davis, who ended up becoming one of USF's all-time greats and leading in practically every category. But, you know, it was a situation, I think, that he came in back in 2012 when he was hired, and I think he thought maybe it was a little bit you know, more under control than it was, and we quickly found out, you know, his first game, they went out and they got trounced by McNeese State at home, and, you know, that first year was a long year, and really ever since then, you know, they went 4-8 last year. They improved by 2 wins, but overall, it's really hard to see where a lot of improvement has come from. You know, it's difficult, I think, when you're coming off, you know, a decade really where USF was one of those up-and-coming programs. They reached number 2 in the nation, you know, back in 2007 under Jim Leavitt. This was a team that many people had tabbed every year to win the Big East and, you know, contend for a BCS bowl, and it just never happened. And in my opinion, just, you know, I've covered this team since he got here, and these next two games are going to be key for him. You know, Memphis, he's coming off a really, you know, embarrassing loss to Maryland. You know, the team, he even said himself, you know, they were, you know, ill prepared. They came in a little lackadaisical. You know, and it didn't really help his case during the bye week when Maryland got blown out by West Virginia on Saturday. So, you know, these next two games with Memphis and Syracuse are really going to tell a lot. And I would probably set the bar at 6-6. If he doesn't get to 6-6 and get to a bowl game this year, I think you're going to be seeing USF looking for a new head coach in 2016.
Yeah, that's it's a tough deal, and we've been there, and you know, I joked with somebody, I was actually talking to somebody about USF last week and made the comment about Skip Holtz leaving the cover at Bear, and I said USF is lucky there was still a Chris Howell big thing. There, you know, we thought we had it bad at Memphis when Justin Fuente came in and there were 7 scholarship offensive linemen. But when you say there was no quarterback, there was literally no quarterback on the roster. So, you know,
well,
that's always a tough deal.
Yeah, well, they had quarterbacks, but I mean it was they had just graduated, BJ Daniels, but they had nobody who had been, that long term star. They had a guy who was a walk on that had led him to victory against Miami back in 2010, but didn't really have any real experience. They had a guy in Matt Floyd who was named the starter, who was named a team captain for that McNeese game, who was pulled after three quarters, never saw the field again, and he actually had a walk out every game after that as the team captain. So he ended up transferring out to South Alabama after the season. But yeah, it was a bad situation, and it was something that he came into, and he tried to instill his offense, and he didn't have the right guys to run it. And I think a lot of fans around here and a lot of people that have followed this program for a long time have that heightened expectation for this team, and they believe that this team should be contending for bowl bursts every year. And it's almost hard to believe this team hasn't even been to a bowl game since 2010 when they were in the Miami Car Care Bowl. So yeah, it's a lot of disappointment. It's a lot of tough times. But he said today, if we can go out, we can upset Memphis. Everything changed at least for a week. The people are going to be, pretty encouraged with it. But if they go out and they lose, by 30 points, there's going to be a lot more calls for his job. And, it's going to show in the stands when they have homecoming next week against Syracuse.
Well, I can tell you that.
I'm sorry, John. How is the perception? Because I was just down there a couple of weeks ago. And there's certainly a perception among the fan base that Central Florida's program has passed South Florida's program. Mm-hmm. Now, not this year, but I mean in general, certainly in the recent last couple of years. Has that put a little extra pressure on him as far as – do you think that put extra pressure on Taggart?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you look at – just even going back before he got here, USF was so high up, as far as where they perceived themselves to be, they didn't even want to play UCF anymore. They wanted this rivalry, or that they wouldn't even consider it a rivalry. They wanted it to be out the door and long forgotten. They used to put UCF with the Florida Internationals of the world and the Florida Atlantics and those lower tier schools in this state. But when UCF jumped out, the first year in this conference, and they went to the BCS bowl game and beat Baylor in the Fiesta Bowl, I mean, that really awakened, I think, a lot of people around here, and it really got a chance to see, just how much UCF had surpassed USF. I mean, even off the field, if you look at, the facilities they have over in Orlando,
yep,
with an on-campus stadium, something USF,
yep,
fans have longed for years. They have an indoor practice facility, something USF doesn't have and has also longed for a couple of years. And, it's interesting because I think you can kind of chalk it up to administrative incompetence on USF's part as well. Skip Holtz, his second year at USF, they went 5-7, and after that, the athletic director at the time, Doug Lord, signed him to a 5-year contract extension. And he was fired the next year. So they're still paying, Skip Holtz to coach at Louisiana Tech. He's still getting a check from USF. They're still paying their former basketball coach, Stan Heath, who also got an extension that year. So I think it's a lot of build up with the incompetence or perceived incompetence of the athletic department, plus UCF's recent success, that I think has kind of triggered a lot more of those emotions that people say, hey, if we're not winning now, get him out of here, and we'll hire somebody who can get it done. I think it's a lot of desperation as well.
And it's really tough in a state like Florida, where there are I think it's like 11 FBS programs, something like that. 11, 12, somewhere in that ballpark. I can't even count them all just off the top of my head.
Right,
I think it's like
you
eight,
can't even.
But,
right, you got you that, right. I mean, just in Miami area alone, there's five.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right?
And that just makes it so much harder for a school like USF, because what is really your best case? I mean, I think what happened back, I think it was 07, I think you're right, when they jump up to number 2 in the country, feeling
mm-hmm.
for you when you're probably 5th or 6th best program, maybe 7th best program in the state, just as far as a program goes. And I just think it's tough to win in that situation. you know, but they do a good job recruiting the state. I mean, you've got 91 kids from the state of Florida, you know, 14 from down around Miami. You know, that's doing a pretty good job of recruiting in the state, you know, and just keep, but that's got to be just such a challenge to try to keep up with Miami and Florida State and Florida and you mentioned UCF and Miami and Port Atlanta. It just goes on and on.
Yeah, you know, and you know, that's a great point you bring up about recruiting. That's something that Willie Taggart has really done a great job of since he got to USF. They've had the top recruiting class in the conference the last 2 years, and really they had one of the best in his first year, and he was only here for a couple months when he got a bunch of these guys to sign. And one of the biggest keys isn't just the recruit in the state, they're recruiting the local area, too. This Tampa Bay area, you know, is rich in high school talent. It's produced some of the, you know, top athletes we've seen around here. If you look around the country, you can look at a guy like Eric Stryker at Oklahoma, big defensive back they have, came out of Armwood High School. Aaron Murray from Plant High School locally, he was the quarterback at Georgia a couple of years ago. Orson Charles was a wide receiver. He's now a tight end in the NFL with the Bengals. So, you know, you're kind of seeing, you know, a lot of success in that terms of it, you know, beating out some of the bigger schools for some guys like Quentin Flowers. He was recruited as an athlete, mainly as a wide receiver, defensive back kind of guy with Alabama and Florida State. So he's had a lot of success in recruiting. It's just been translating that into results in the field that's been the biggest issue. And, you know, when you compare this team to the Floridas and the Florida States and the Miamis, you know, there was a time, you know, under Jim Leavitt and, you know, even in Skip Holtz's early in his tenure,
absolutely,
where this team was world beaters. They were going out, they were beating Auburn in Florida, or the Florida State. They came close to beating Florida in Skip's first year in 2010, and they went down to Miami and beat Miami. And this team, I think the marketing department at one point put up a billboard that kind of enraged Jim Leavitt a little bit a few years back that said, you know, welcome to the Big Four with USF's logo and Florida State and Miami and Florida's logo. So, you know, there was a time where this program considered itself among those elite programs, and it's kind of like you're watching it all crumble down these last couple of years, just seeing how well they can compete with a good program in like the first half. And then the second half rolls around, and they just completely fall apart. And, you know, that's one of the things that Willie Taggart's really been searching for, is that signature victory. And you could really argue that if they can beat Memphis on Friday, that would be his first real signature win that he's gotten since he took the job from Western Kentucky a couple of years back.
All right, Jeff, so what do you think is going to happen on Friday night? How do you think it's going to all shake out?
Well, I mean, it's really tough, you know, for any program to have to go against this Memphis offense. I mean, I watched the game against Cincinnati last week, and the sheer talent that this team has on offense with Paxton Lynch and these receivers. And, you know, Lynch is a big guy. We talked to Nate Godwin today, one of the USF defensive backs, and he said that, you know, going up against Paxton Lynch last season, he noticed that this guy is probably the biggest quarterback height-wise that USF's seen, you know, probably all season long. So I think he creates a lot of matchup difficulties because he has a tendency where he can run the ball if there's no, you know, buddy open downfield. USF has problems that way in that, you know, regard. USF still feeling out its offense. They still have really searching for that offensive identity.
We got your solution. Our defensive backs have got your solution.
That's right.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, that is true. Memphis's defense hasn't been the best bunch out there. But I mean, it's tough to say. I don't see it being a blowout. I do think Memphis, you know, is going to get up there in points again. I think their streak of 40 or more ends, just because of the improvements I've seen for USF's defense. So, I mean, if I had to put a score on it, I'd probably put 31-17 Memphis, and I think that's probably the most fair score. Even like the bettors out in Las Vegas, I noticed last night the line
for
this game has
gone
from like 12 down to 11 down to 9, so maybe they're thinking it's a trap game for Memphis, but USF has never historically had success during the week in weekday games on ESPN, so I think they're 0-10 or 0-11 like in the all time on ESPN, like Thursday or Friday, so it's a little bit of a tough going there for them too, and that national spotlight comes on.
Yeah, and I noticed that they're one. Coach Taggart is 1-4 coming off bye weeks as well, and that's that's usually I don't tell anybody their coach is not good or bad or whatever, but that's usually not a real good sign of a, you know, coming off bye weeks with a week to prepare. You're 1-4. Mm-hmm. That's usually that's what the Vegas folks like to call a trend. So, all right, Jeff, we'll tell everybody how they can find
you. Before we let him get off, I've got to ask him about the quote now. One of your, I believe it was one of your players that said
it was
that,
Nate Goodwin. It was the same guy he just mentioned.
Nate Goodwin said that that they were built for offenses like Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
What's he talking about?
I don't think he meant it as a slight for Memphis. I think that he meant it more as a you know, USF kind of has that personnel where the system they're running this year and that scheme kind of matches up pretty well against a pass-heavy offense. I mean, I think maybe he forgot they also run the football pretty well, too, in Memphis. So,
we had
that could be a problem.
We had a guy running on him last year, so.
Yeah, exactly. So I maybe think it might have been a little momentary lapse in judgment, but I'm pretty sure that might be a little bit of bulletin board material for the Tigers on Friday, but I'm not sure that they'll need, you know, much more of that going into the game.
So Jeff, go ahead and tell everybody how they can find you on Facebook and whatnot.
I'm sorry, you broke up there. I didn't get to hear the rest of the question there.
Yeah, I said just go ahead and tell everybody how they could get in touch with you or how they could find you on social media and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, perfect. Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at @byjeffodom. That's @byjeffodom. You can follow me during the game, myself and my trusty partner in crime, Joey Knight, who's at @TBTimes_Bulls. We will cover the game, you know, all the way around on Friday night, and you have a couple more interview sessions these next couple of days with the team to kind of, you know, get in the swing of things as far as into Friday's game goes. So you can also get our coverage on TampaBay.com and also USFOracle.com. That's where I'm the sports editor there as well. So you can kind of follow all of our coverage. We kind of cover all the bases down here for all USF athletics and football too.
Awesome, Jeff. Well, thanks a lot for joining us again, especially on such short notice. We appreciate it, and good luck to the Bulls the rest of the way.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks. That was Jeff Odom from Tampa Bay, TampaBay.com. Works for Tampa Bay Times. Thanks to him for coming on tonight. We really appreciate it. And Larry, you know, I think that it's time to do what we like to do best. Let's see, the game kicks off at 6.
Yep.
So if we extrapolate that every week, we've added 30 minutes to game time. No, I fear for my approval rating. The first 2 weeks we were right about 3 hours, and then against Bowling Green we jumped up to 3:37. That game on Thursday night was 4 hours and 7 minutes. I may throw myself a lake. I will be camping by the game goes 4 hours and 7 minutes on Friday. Pretty optimistic. And we're going to say that at approximately 9:30 Central Time on Friday night, as we're watching ESPN, as we are listening to let me get back over to it, as we are listening to Dave Fleming and Mac Brown call the game with Allison Williams on the side. Interesting note, that's the team that also called the Miami Beach Bowl last year. Our big win against BYU, who lost 31-0 this week, and nothing's made me happier throughout the week, but that's neither here nor there. So when we're looking at that scoreboard at 9:30 on Friday night Central Time, it will say
41-24 Memphis.
I had 31-17 written down, so I'm not going to let Jeff steal my thunder. That's exactly what I thought. You know, if you're right, the Tigers will then have seven straight games. I do too, I will make a bold prediction. This will be the Jamarius Henderson breakout game. This will be the game.
You know, I thought about that, actually, and I thought he should have gotten the ball more last week. As much as I love Cooper, he is –
Well, I didn't understand why he didn't get the ball more either.
Well, that's a whole different animal. Huh? I think there's some gunslinger mentality in Justin. And,
yeah.
And I think once they started running the ball or scoring, throwing the ball, I think he was like, oh, yeah, really? This way? So and if you guys think that doesn't happen to coaches, you're crazy.
Absolutely does.
Absolutely does.
You made a point last week about coaches being very controlling. They're also the most competitive people in the country. I mean, that
when he saw
Tupperville and the plan they had,
yeah.
This would be good.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, the Calipari store?
Yeah, this will be entertaining.
That my mother-in-law has a business where she sells office supplies. And there's also a lot of people know that John has a typewriter that he likes to type all of his offer sheets on. He's very, very – he's also superstitious. So he uses this typewriter. And so you have to order these ribbons – to get them. And my mother-in-law is one of the few people around town that has one of these old, you get stuff for older, typewriters, because now everybody uses a computer, right? John would come in and buy these ribbons. Now, mind you, we're talking, John's contract was, multi-million dollars, right? John would negotiate with this woman for a better price, okay? And it wasn't about a buddy of mine was telling me, he's like, this wasn't about the money. It was about him winning.
It's about winning. That's
it. It's about winning.
That's all he cares.
So that's right. He didn't care about the money. He worried about winning. And that's not a good or bad Cal story. That's just a fact. And so your point to these coaches being very competitive. What I think you're going to see this week, I do think our defense is going to play better. I think they were embarrassed last week, and I think they're going to play a lot better. I also think our coaches are going to call a better game. The only thing that scares me in this game is their quarterback is a pretty good running quarterback, which we all know that we struggle with.
Yeah. Gosh, it's crazy how much we struggle with the running quarterback. Jake Elliott, last time out at South Florida.
was running on it. Oh,
yeah. It was not pretty. So Jake Elliott last year down there at the South Florida game booted a school record 56-yard field goal the last time we actually played down there. So,
right.
That'll be an important part of the game as well. Yeah, and that's a great school record. But, I don't know. I think we'll run the ball, you said, a little more. We've got to work on better. Since the Missouri State game, we threw a touchdown pass. Our first possession since then have been fumble, punt, fumble. And our opponent, Kansas, was a punt, touchdown pass, touchdown run. So we've got to start better. I think that's my big key to the game is just starting better. We can't turn the ball over on our first drive again. We've done it for 2 hours. We just can't afford to do that on Friday night against USF. We really can't afford to do it anymore. We need to have gotten that out of our system. And I think if we do that, I think we can control the line of scrimmage. I mean, I would like to think against South Florida, Memphis can control the line of scrimmage, which will, some good things. So I think, again, that if we can control the line of scrimmage, that'll lead to victory for the Tigers. So Larry's got 41-24. I've got 31-17. Jeff had 31-17 Memphis. That would run the 2-0 in league play, but we're not going to count our chickens before they hatch. I haven't even told Larry. Larry, I think we are going to have a show next week. We'll just have an abbreviated program next week. We'll make it.
Yeah.
I want to get into a couple things outside of football next week because we'll have, you know, we'll only have a recap to talk about, and then we'll have a week off before the Ole Miss game. But tonight I want to touch on as a segment here, I want to talk about targeting and hitting in general. I admit I was wrong about one near hit. Looked worse than it did. Still don't like guys hitting guys up high, no matter what. I just don't like. There are two things that bother me today: hit a guy and cut blocking. I watched Navy last week. They ran six consecutive offensive plays where not one offensive lineman kept their feet. And I think that's dangerous. And everybody's like, oh, it's a part of football. Well, we've learned what should be in football. And clearly, blows to the head and targeting are not our football activities. I think Lanier's hit was questionable. I think it was borderline. When you look at it slowed down at the slowest speed, yes, he hit him with the shoulder. But he still ducked his head. And, you know, you were taught when you were coming up, and it's what I was taught, see what you're hitting. I mean, that's, you know, that's number one.
Yep.
You got to have your head up.
Yep.
Chauncey didn't see what he hit. And it's scary, you know, and I gave Tuberville a really hard time last week. And what we talked about proved to fruition that Gunnar Keel had no business being on the football field last Saturday or Thursday. And then to top off the student and of Tuberville in a minute, but I just want to top it off. On Friday, and I quote, a reporter asked him about Keel's status for their game Saturday, which is preposterous to me why you would even have to ask, which he had right now.
Why did you even ask the question?
Tommy Tuberville said, well, he lost some feeling in his hands and fingers, but he's better. He's doing a little better now. He's really sore. His neck and his head hurt, but we don't know what his status is for Saturday. What do you mean you don't know what his status
is
for Saturday?
The kid, but anyway,
I don't want to get off too deep on it. But
let's be very clear. Kid.
Right.
Okay? We're talking about a 20-year-old kid, okay?
With a future.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
People forget, he was the number one recruit in college, high school football when he came out. He was the number one recruit, not number one quarterback,
well, he committed,
the number one player in the country.
LSU and Notre Dame.
Yeah.
If I'm not incorrect.
Yeah, no, you're right. And then I think he went to Notre Dame and transferred. I don't remember the whole story.
I don't remember.
Story. It's really not important, but
it doesn't matter. But here's the point. You're talking about a quarterback,
right?
And as far as your question about targeting, to me, first of all, I would have been flagged like 19,000 times.
Yeah, exactly.
But they're right. Don't launch yourself at a guy. Don't do that. There's no reason to have to launch yourself. Now I will defend some DBs on this. You're jumping for the ball and you hit a guy and they get called for targeting. That's crap because you're jumping for the ball and that guy jumps for the ball and you run into each other. So I think we have to refine and we need to define a little better what targeting is. But the core point that you're making is don't launch at a guy. I have a rule.
Don't hit down.
NFL's rule. You know, if a guy's going to the ground, don't dive at him. If you're running
right.
and you see him go to the ground, just fall down or jump over him, or you've got plenty of time to do that. Now, in this particular case, Gunner went down late.
And I thought
our player made a good attempt to move. He I don't know that it was all his fault. I thought the way Gunner slid kind of contributed to it a little bit.
It did, and it did,
and that's always the challenge.
You know, and that's always the challenge. You know, you made a point a few minutes ago that you'd have gotten 19,000 fouls. We didn't know when you played. We didn't know what that did to you, and we didn't know what the repetitive head trauma. You know, but I've always known what a good hit looks like and what a borderline hit looks like. And the Lanier hit was borderline. I'm sorry. It just, it was. And it's hard for these guys to stop on a dime and not hit somebody. But at the end of the day, too, we're not talking about me out there trying to control my body hitting somebody. These guys are finely tuned athletic machines that, you know, that hit was, my thing is, it's going to be questionable.
It was a confluence of a lot of things right there. But you're right. I mean, I do think that there's way too much of a guy's going to the ground and you dive at him. That's garbage. And when you see that,
you just can't do that.
Or diving at a guy's, diving into a guy to try to get the big hit. That happens, and that needs to go away. And look, these are kids, so they get excited. And I want to give one shout out too. And this is sort of off topic, but I do want to give a shout out to Sam Kraft. He started off the game terribly and finished really well. And you can't off by a whole lot worse, but he finished so much better. And you know what that means? That shows character, because you're on national TV.
Yep.
And you played terribly for a whole half. And there in the end of the third quarter, fourth quarter, we don't win that game without Sam. So, shout out to Sam.
And he, we always talk about the coaches making adjustments and whatnot. That's an adjustment on Sam's part to realize, two quick fumbles. And, I don't know if he knows teams. But then I could see him on the sideline wanting to be in the game, wanting to make plays. And that's the mark of a great player is, I screwed up, but I got the ability to make it better. I mean, that's the thing, is I can make it better. So, that was pretty, I tell you, I thought that the officiating crew was a total clown show. I'll be perfectly clear and honest. It was so bad.
You don't need to be out there. Bottom line.
Tony tweeted, he said, I think he did a great job in their incompetence around the bus. And we can talk about targeting and rules all we want, but we have a problem. And this is college and pro. We have a problem in this country with officiating. And this is not just a football thing. This is a sport problem where I don't know if it's guys are slower than the game. Guys are older. Guys are different. I don't know what the problem
is. Well, the game
is
faster.
We have a problem where the game is so fast, and you've got the officials that have been doing this for 20 years. And a good official is a good, Ed Hockley, until this past Sunday, I had never heard anybody say a bad word about anything Ed Hockley said, or did. But you know what, Cam Newton? By the way, if you didn't hear the story, Cam Newton – oh, I have no doubt he said it, and there's no doubt he said it.
He said something, but he didn't say
here's
that.
Here's a flash,
anyway.
Cam Newton. You're not old enough to get that call. Settle down.
Why do you think it was a deserved call anyway? They Cam Newton was
over
there trying to earn an Academy Award, man. I mean, the guy breathes on him, and he's like falling down, holding his ankle, and he looks like a soccer player out there. But anyway,
and then one other thing that I want to touch on that kind of goes along with all of this, I and Michael Felder in the Bleachers on Twitter, which if you follow college football and you do not follow him, you are doing it wrong. We had a lengthy discussion today about a chart that Dr. David Rudd posted that showed that college football games are increasing in length. They're going to be about 3 hours, 20 minutes this year. Here's the verification of that. The Memphis, Cincinnati, and Washington, who did they play? The Giggles, the Eagles on tonight? Yeah.
The Washington Redskins and the
Giants. Sorry.
Giants.
I'm sorry. I got my totally inept NFC East teams mixed up there. Sorry about that. They went, the third quarter ended at the same, almost, it was so funny, because somebody said it was almost at the exact same for both games.
But they started an hour later.
They started an hour later than we did.
There was an injury timeout. There was an injury time in that.
Yeah.
But
look, and there's a lot of factors in length of game. No, and you know, everybody jokes with me about the Energon Maddox have problems. Number one, stopping the clock for a first down is stupid. There's a reason the NFL doesn't do it. In today's pace, when teams are getting to the line and wanting to snap the football, in today's pace, we need to get rid of that rule. It's been incredibly dumb for years, and it needs to be just done away with now.
If you want to keep it for the last 2 minutes, that's fine. You can keep it for the last 2 minutes.
I don't think so.
Because those start doing that, they're setting the chains. I mean, but the rest of the game, I totally agree. There's no reason to stop the clock for a first down. That's just dumb.
You know, and I don't even think there is in the last 2 minutes because, again, back to my point, I think for it now, and teams are moving faster anyway. And that's so infuriating, guys like me and Mike Felder, is the game is so much faster than 80 and 90 plays and 14 seconds between plays. How are the games getting longer? Well, there's several reasons. Number one, which will never go away, that's TV timeouts. That's never going away, so people can quit complaining. TV is going to take – they're actually going to probably table adding another timeout next year to kind of follow the NFL kickoff after a score, take another timeout. So that's not going away. Replay, we've got to shorten that somehow. Now, the three replays we had on Thursday night, one took, I think it was 3.5 minutes, one was 5.5 minutes, and the other was actual time, not of game time, but of actual time. So, you know, we got to do something about those things. But, you know, timeouts are not going away. You can change the first down rule. You know, in my opinion, you could have a 25-second play clock for every play. Forget all this mess of, well, for this, it's 30, it's 25. Or let's settle on a 30-second play clock. And it's always 30 seconds every time.
It's always 30. It doesn't matter. Right. I agree.
That would shorten the game greatly. You know, and then things like dead ball situations, like on field goals. And I know it doesn't seem like much, but on a field goal at the end of the game, statistics have never shown that, quote-unquote, icing the kicker is effective. You know, so unless you're trying to prevent a penalty on defense, which Jim McElwain actually was doing when he called the first time out on that 55-yard field attempt by Tennessee, unless you're doing it to prevent a penalty, I don't think you should be able to call a timeout. Yeah, I don't think you should be able to call a timeout to, quote-unquote, ice the kicker. I think once the players are set on a deal like that, the play has to go. If you want to call your timeout, call it before the players are set. I just think those and then one other, this has to get off my lawn, you're crushing my grass kind of deal. But, you know, Larry, and you've played and I've watched football a long time. Nothing frustrates me more as a football fan than to watch a quarterback come to the line with, we'll say it's 25-second play clock. They call their play. They come to the line with 20. They snap the damn ball with 3 on the play clock. Coaches always say, I want to eliminate the dead ball penalties and the dumb mistakes. How about snapping the damn ball? How about let's try that? Let's try to snap the ball. And a great job of that, the way, you know, when we get to the line, if we get to the line with 17 seconds, that ball's out. And even when we change plays, it's about being able to do things fast.
To your point of shortening the play clock, because if you've got 30 seconds between you can't come to the line and stand there, I don't really mind that as much. I think the main thing that's lengthened the game is the passing, and the fact that a lot of times when you pass the football, players go out of bounds. So here's the solution: there is, unless it's in the last 2 minutes when the player goes out of bounds, once the ball is set, start the clock.
Yeah.
That's simple.
Yeah. I think.
Start the clock.
Yeah. But I hear coaches just talk all the time about, well, we've got to eliminate the dead ball mistakes from the game. And you know, our guys have got to be sharp. No, your guys need, if they come up to the line with 17 seconds on the clock, around 11, 12 seconds. You don't need 14 more seconds to see what the defense is going to do. Come up, snap the ball onto the next play. And I just think that would speed – there's so many little things that could speed the game up. And, look, people want to talk about TV and all that. TV is a deal with them. Everybody wants to be on TV, but now that we have TV, look, TV's in business to make one thing with sports, and that's money. And the only way they can make money is with advertising. So commercials are going to be a part of the game. It's also going to be a situation where, you know, another TV timeout. Sure is the smallest going to be a timeout in the next couple of years. You know, back to the officiating, Jeb just tweeted a great point. 30 years ago, the NCAA rules for football were 2.5, I think it was like 2.5 mimeographed pages, front and back. So, what, 4 pages? It's 350 today. We've put too much of a burden on these guys to try to cover every possible scenario. I'll give you a great example. The whole thing last week when everybody was asking if we could wear the 901 helmets. I had to go digging through the rules, and there's still some disagreement whether or not it applies, but I think it, and hey, it makes my point, my show, so hey, I'm right. no, I'm just kidding. But, you know, it is a number or a mark other than your official logo or an alternate logo on your uniform. Why do I need three sections, three articles, seven sections, and like 4 or 5 pieces of each section under the footwear. I mean, that's what kills the game.
I have no idea.
Why do I need so much information for these guys to process when, as you said earlier, Larry, the game is so much faster. These guys are doing the best they can, but then replaying, you know, some officials say, you know what, I don't have to be as sharp because replay can catch it. When, you know, a lot of times things go to replay, there was a play in the Tennessee game that had no business going to replay, that it was as plain as the nose on your face what happened. Or then the other side of it is, and I think you talked about this, the replay officials got to have the guts to say, guys, yep, you're wrong. You missed it. You blew it. You blew the call. So I just think those are issues that, you know, we have got to come to terms with in college football. We've got to shorten these games. We've got officials to officiate. And again, if the officials are standing there and it's taking you 30 seconds, 45 seconds, a minute and a half for them to determine what the penalty was, who it was on, where it was at, you know, what it was. If it's taking you a minute and a half to figure it out.
There's some things I could see taking a minute or two to, because once you say, okay, well, he didn't fumble the ball, so where should the ball be and how much time's on the clock? Okay, fine. But if it's a – if you take 5 minutes and you come out to call the play stands as called, I want to throw stuff at you. Because, because okay, how did it take that damn long for you to figure out that there's inconclusive evidence? I mean, there's not that many freaking angles to look at. Here's the other thing. If you watch on TV, okay, they can cycle through every angle of that play in a minute. I mean, or a minute and a half. You can cycle through it. And you can say, okay, well, I want to go back and see this one or two a couple of times. It still only takes a couple of minutes. So I don't get it. And, you know, I was sitting there, I was sure as the world they were going to uphold the fumble call on Kraft. And I was glad they didn't. I'm glad they overturned it. But at the end of the day,
it was wrong.
It was wrong. They still got it wrong.
It took them 9 minutes to get a call wrong. And, I mean, those are the things that I look at, Larry, and I know we see eye to eye on a lot of this stuff. That's the stuff I look at that drives me insane.
Yeah, that is insane.
Yeah, folks. Yep. I mean, I did not walk out until like 10:40 on a Thursday night for a game started at 7.
And let's put this, forget you and me, okay, because we're adults. We made a decision to go to the game and be useless at work the next day. Fine. That's our grown-up decision, okay? But what about, and I'm dead serious about this, don't give me this crap that these kids don't go to school. A lot of those kids do go to school. And a lot of those players did have to be in class on Friday. And a lot of those players, I mean, they played a freaking football game and had to get up.
And trust me when I tell you, because I've done it, it hurts like hell to get up. Okay? And when you have to get up and go to class, and yes, you are human, and it hurts. And you get up, and you're standing there going, I want to be anywhere but standing in this shower right now.
That's right.
And the later these kids get back to the dorm, get back and get into, you know, into bed, some of them are going to get up and go, you know what? I'm not going to philosophy this morning. So there is a real tangible thing of, hey, I'm not a big proponent of Thursday night games. Anyway, for college, I mean, NFL, these guys get paid millions. Whatever. It doesn't matter. But for colleges, now, Friday night game's okay. I mean, that's, you don't have to go to school the next day. But a Thursday night game,
yeah,
that's tough. And I'm just not a big fan. So, anyway.
Oh, well, I mean, think about all the leagues that do Tuesday night games. I mean, think about Tuesday, the action. The Tigers and the Bulls will face off on ESPN2. Kickoff will be at 6 p.m. Central. Dave Fleming, Mac Brown, and Allison Williams will be the broadcast team for the Tigers and the Bulls. Tigers, if we're fine, are an 8.5-point favorite as of right now. Again, that's a game that opened at 10. I found it at
MFI.com. What's the over-under on that, John?
That's you know, it's funny. That's exactly where I was going to go look that up, because that, last week I told everybody to stay away from the line and take the over, and that would have been a really, really, really solid, safe bet last week.
Our pastor wanted to know that if everybody did take the over, he expected more in the offering place.
The over under looks like it's 62 for 62? The game on Friday night. So 62.
Over,
so I don't know.
I'm gonna
stay away from. I'm gonna encourage folks to just run away. This is a poison game from the bettor's perspective. Just run away. If I was a fan of either team, this is not one that I would wager on, because I don't like the line. I don't like the over. I just don't know. I haven't seen enough of South Florida. That's my big thing. I haven't seen enough of the Bulls to make an educated decision. So,
well, let's put it this way.
All right, well,
Hayden Moore passed for more yards last week than their quarterback has passed for in the whole season. So,
that is,
there you go.
So, Larry, tell everybody how they can find you.
Well, I'm on Twitter at Cubs Tigers Grizz. Don't let the Cubs scare you. I don't talk about the Cubs that much. This season maybe a little. But
the Cardinals, when we talk about the Cubs, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, well, whatever. But but you're welcome to follow me, and please interact. If any of the fans want ask a question or have a question for the show, please let me know, and we'll be happy to discuss it.
Absolutely. And you can follow me at John Maddox on Twitter and also on Facebook. I'm there. I'm all over the place. Co-host and all the land. This is Larry Marley. This is John Maddox signing off, saying let's go run the Bulls out of town and go Tigers go. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to Tigers Tonight. The opinions of all guests appearing on this show are their own and do not reflect the views of their employers. Tigers Tonight is not affiliated with the University of Memphis in any way. Join us next week for Tigers Tonight.